Attention Ditto Heads. Attention Bo Scouts.
Goes by the pseudonym Bo Snerdly.
It's time for the Soul of Excellence.
He is a radio host here in New York.
The Rush Hour is on the air.
Rush, rush.
Now here's James Golden.
So Senator Schumer voted no. He wasn't even publicly in favor of all this. Why is this his fault?
Oh, look, he orchestrated it. Here are a few of the facts. Senator Shaheen was on this morning saying every negotiation was run by him every day. His number two, Dick Durbin, voted for it. And then did you notice that all eight senators who voted for it were not up for re-election in 2026? That's not a coincidence. This was done with Senator Schumer's blessing. I think people are more upset that he doesn't just come out and say that. And if you're not going to lead in stopping premium hikes on health care, in preserving the Affordable Care Act, then it's time for you to step aside.
Welcome, my friends, to the Tuesday edition of Bo Snerdly's Rush Hour. The anger is palpable. Democrats upset with their leadership in the midst of a failed shutdown, which should be completely gotten rid of by the end of the week. The House of Representatives comes back into session tomorrow. Before we get into the ins and outs, it is so refreshing to see a political party tearing itself apart, engaged in a circular firing squad, and it not be the Republicans. Can't tell you how refreshing that is. But before we get into all of that, it is Veterans Day across this America, and is with every significant American holiday. We call upon the official historian of this show, my dear friend and colleague from Days with Rush Limbaugh Show. He was web producer with Rush. He is the founder of HistoryAuthor.com. He is a columnist with the New York Sun. And he is also, by the way, a fellow broadcaster as well. Man of many talents. And author, I might add. Not just of history books, but cuisine as well. You know, Carlos, Dean and his wife wrote a book on Greek cuisine. Yes, Carlos is from Greece. Dean, I don't know whether you know that or not.
So, no, he never met you then, which is surprising. Because Greeks usually like to call out other Greeks.
Yeah, so Dean Karyanis is with us, ladies and gentlemen. It is Veterans Day. You know, Dean, I mentioned last night to my niece, well, tomorrow's Armistice Day. And she had, and this is not to slight her, of course, no, she had no clue what I was talking about when I said Armistice Day. What day? Armistice Day. And then I said, does the phrase the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month mean anything to you? Were you taught anything about that when you were attending school? And again, and I'm not slighting her at all. This is just the reality. No, we were never taught anything about that. Dean, Armistice Day, which is now known as Veterans Day. Tell us about that day and how it is and why it is important for Americans to honor it.
Well, thanks to everybody for listening, first of all, especially through that long introduction, which I appreciate, but I cringe a little bit. I'm not good at taking the compliments, but because I want it to be about the veterans. I sincerely do, and not just the ones who might be listening out there right now that I thank for their service, but those great war veterans, the World War I veterans that you just mentioned, the ones that saw the bloodshed stop on that 11th day in 1919, was the first Armistice Day, but on the 11th hour, or at the 11th hour in the 11th month, on the 11th day. And I always stick up for them. I always feel that World War I is so much death, so much sacrifice for really no purpose, because we come back for World War II. And a lot of people just want to skip ahead. They only have so much time to learn things in history. I'm sure that's the case with your niece in schools. They only have so much space in a history textbook. So they go and they, oh, well, World War II, that's the one we still talk about. That's the one that really redrew the map. World War I doesn't settle much. But at the time, the people who lived through it, that was the Great War. That was a massive conflict. And it did change the face of the country. You had people shambling around for many years that had the injuries from the gas attacks, poison gas, who had lived in the trenches, who lost limbs, just as with the Civil War. And you even had one private, Private Nicholas Gunther. He was the last man killed, the last American killed. And that was when they knew that the armistice was coming, because the people negotiating that treaty had to wait, which I always thought was a little strange. If you decided an armistice, how about we stop the killing right now? But they decided to wait for a really symbolic moment, the 11-11-11. And he charged the German machine gun nest. People on both sides are telling this 23-year-old private, stop, the war is over. And unfortunately, he ends up being killed. He's the last man who's killed. General Blackjack Pershing says he's the last one. And today, for Veterans Day, it's not about men like that, like Gunther, who laid down their lives, but the men who were seeing that happen. Those are the veterans. And I think we tend to think of veterans today, because we haven't lived through a world war, thank God, most of us. We think of them as, well, they come home, they get a discount card. We appreciate them. We watch movies, unfortunately, instead of really speaking to people, just a sign of our modern world. But they had to watch one of their comrades get gunned down. You had George H.W. Bush, the infamous Chichijima incident. He gets shot down, and he's with 8 Navy and Marine airmen, and they all get captured by the Japanese, tortured. There's cannibalism. Some of them are eaten by the Japanese soldiers. He has to carry that guilt with him as the pilot of that plane, as the survivor. He has survivor's guilt, did George H.W. Bush. And so I think that that's what's so important about going back to Armistice Day and reading and looking at some of the memoirs of these men. I covered 2 yesterday. I played because I guest hosted for our friend Derek Hunter on his podcast, and I had interviewed 2 World War II veterans. They both passed on now. One of them was 103, who'd been there at Pearl Harbor, at the Pearl Harbor attack, Lieutenant Jim Downing. And the other one was Roger Boas, who was with Patton's Army, was one of the first Americans to liberate a Nazi concentration camp. And that's one of the reasons I do the History Author Show interviews, is because if there is a young person like your niece, or if there's somebody out there listening now who says, I never really thought much about World War One. I hear all the time about World War Two, and we seem to be living forever on the aftermath, or in the aftermath of World War Two. But it is important to remember how this starts, how this is this massive global conflict. It launches us into the world stage, onto the world stage, America. But there are real people who needed to pay the price for that. And yes, they came home. Yes, they got parades, but they would often be signs outside businesses, no soldiers allowed, because like today, they feared that there might be something wrong with them. They might suffer from, at the time, they called it soldier's heart, or they called it battle rattle, which is the name of Roger Boas's memoir. And people were afraid of them. Shell shock. That's the one we know from World War One. So I think that what you did was absolutely right, with asking those questions and the way that you asked them of young people, especially, because that's the only way you were going to learn. And I always say in history, I have plenty of things I've thought were right that turned out to be wrong, or stories that I didn't know. And I always say it benefits me nothing to be wrong. I want to learn those stories. I want to expand my own horizon. When I see the about 150 different World War One memorials around New York City, I want to put faces to those names, because they were just like us. And they don't deserve to just be black and white photographs in books or grainy footage in movies.
I'll tell you one of the things that I think is very difficult, Dean, and that, well, there are 2 points I want to make. The first one is, as much as I have studied history, if someone were to ask me point blank, give me the elevator pitch on why World War One was fought, I would have struggled doing it. We can talk about the events that happened with the Archduke of Ferdinand and all the rest of it, but why? And why was World War One even fought? What were the conflicts that led to a world being engulfed in war in Europe, and America getting dragged in? It's a difficult war to explain to people, to me anyway, or to understand. But the second point is, we differentiate World War One and World War Two, and really it is the conclusion of World War One that led directly to World War Two. It was in some people, and I've seen it written, that it is the same war with a 30-year gap in between. What do you think about that?
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. It's a pause. It's one of the reasons why when people were calling for yet another ceasefire with Hamas in Gaza, folks like us, I imagine, were both yelling. I certainly wrote about it at the New York Sun. That's not how you get victory. You get victory, and this will sound very familiar to you from all those rest years, but because it's true, you don't get victory by calling a break. This was the case even in the Gulf War with the so-called Highway of Death. And they said, oh, they're running away. And General Schwarzkopf and General Powell said, well, there's a difference between withdrawing to fight again another day and a surrender. If they want to surrender, they can lay down their weapons. But just withdrawing and leaving them intact to fight another day is not a way that you're going to have a lasting peace. And you think of the way that we did it in the Civil War in the United States. And people say, well, people are starving in Gaza. Well, show me a war where people weren't starving. That was literally the objective of the Union, was to implement Winfield Scott's Anaconda Plan to strangle the South and to, like an anaconda. And people were distilling their urine to get supplies to make bombs. People were starving. People were eating sawdust bread. They were eating rats at Vicksburg. When U.S. Grant surrounded Vicksburg, demanded their surrender, they would not surrender. They end up surrendering on July 4th and don't celebrate July 4th for many years after that, till the Second World War, really is the story. People, obviously, they had lingering anger about that. That's what war is. War is not, well, we'll take a break. And this is also, by the way, what the Imperial Japanese hoped. They saw what the U.S. and the Allies did in World War One, and they thought, well, if we can make it really painful for them, they won't make us surrender. They won't force us to lay down our arms, and we can just come back another time and finish the genocide of Asia and put ourselves in control. We won't lose the empire. And of course, Truman ends up dropping those nuclear bombs and forcing their unconditional surrender. That's how you win a war. And I think because World War One is inconclusive, you think, well, why would I want to read all the early things? There's no point to it, you feel like, almost. And also the map is completely changed. Those people aren't there. We think of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Who is out there thinking of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, unless it's for Paul Rubin's guest shot on 30 Rock with a little shriveled hand? No, nobody ever thinks of them. And so we have found a hard time relating, but we really have to. And for me and my wife, for instance, her grandfather was in the Great War, and she has his diary, and we have his picture on the wall prominently. I walk by it every day. And I think it is important to know them. And that helps us know ourselves. And it helps us understand when we vote, when we commit to the country, when we get angry maybe about things in the country, that we have people watching over our shoulders from history. And some of them are still with us now, certainly some veterans from more recent conflicts. I think it just makes us better citizens. And so go wherever you get it. You don't have to go to historyauthor.com, but I have a bunch of interviews there on World War One. It's a war that starts because I think we forget those things. You know, the Civil War had been a long time before. And as far as the cause of the war, I think you'll approve of laying a lot of it at the foot of Woodrow Wilson as far as the American involvement. I think if Theodore Roosevelt is president that year, if he doesn't run in 1912 and has another shot, he knew all the players. I think he might have calmed things down. And this is something that Lieutenant Jim Downing, that Pearl Harbor survivor I interviewed, said. He said, weakness invites aggression. Keep America strong. He was a big supporter of President Reagan and that peace through strength. So I think that's the answer. Yeah, it's tough to pin down. You say, why did you do it for nothing? But sometimes wars happen that way.
James Golden with you here. Snurley, tell you what, Dean, stick around. We got to move into current day. I'm going to talk about shutdown. So why don't you hang around for that? That war, the political war that's taking place in America. We'll jump to that in a moment. 1978, on this day, Donna Summer starts off 3 weeks in the number one slots across the U.S. singles chart with her version of Jimmy Webb's MacArthur Park. It was also a hit for Richard Harris in 1968. Also, on this day, Donna Summer goes to number one with her album Live and More. James Golden, Snurley, Most Snurley's Rush Hour. keep it right here and do not go away.
James Golden, known popularly as Bo Snerdly.
This is the Rush Hour with James Golden.
Rush.
I think my party crossed a line of now putting 42 million Americans with their SNAP benefits and making flying less safe and that kinds of chaos and not paying our military. I mean, that was a red line for me that I can't cross as a Democrat. And I think that's been described country over the party. And now that I think that's been the truth throughout it. And it's only wrong to shut our government down. And I'm relieved. But the people now that are going to get paid and fed and millions of Americans, they're going to be flying now. That's going to be made more safe and restored.
That, of course, John Fetterman, senator from Pennsylvania. 1952 on this day, Paul Kousel was born from the singing group The Kousels. 1967, of course, this went to number two, The Rain, The Park, and Other Things. The Partridge Family, the TV show The Partridge Family, was based on the Kousels family, by the way. She seems so sweet and kind. James Golden, Snerdly with you here. Dean Karyanis is here, New York Sun columnist, the founder of HistoryAuthor.com, and our show's official historian, Dean Shutdown. What is your take on the impact of this longest shutdown of government in America?
Well, gosh, it seems like shutdown season. Earlier every year, they start playing the greatest hits, the shutdown music in October. And boy, again, I would say, what if they threw a shutdown and nobody came? That's how this one felt. That old, well, it was a Great War slogan. We were talking about World War I, but adopted by the hippies and the anti-war movement in the Vietnam era when LBJ was ramping that involvement up. But I think a lot of people are wise to it now, and I think a lot of people are seeing it just as a pantomime. That's usually my word for it. And it's hurting people. It's shooting through your base. It's causing people pain. That's what these shutdowns are designed to do. You remember with the shutdown under President Obama that he was shuttering the World War II Memorial, which is outdoors. He was even putting them outside places, historical sites that weren't run by the federal government, such as the William McKinley Library in Canton, Ohio. He was putting cones up. They came out and said, what is this? We're privately owned and he's shutting us down. And they put them up at Mount Rushmore, which all you have to do is look up and you can see Mount Rushmore. You don't need guides or bathrooms or other things that you might sometimes, but the point is they try to make them painful. And if people feel pain, they'll do what we want them to do. And ultimately this ends up blowing up in Chuck Schumer's face, as you said there, was in your clip. Of course, he's the majority leader. I mean, the minority leader, aspiring majority leader. And I think that they need to find a strategy beyond just, we hate Trump. We hate him. We want to say no, 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 no. It's like two-year-olds. And I know there used to be that claim the Republicans were the party of no. But you did have Gingrich in there working, talking to President Clinton. You did have him pushing him on things like welfare reform. There seems to no longer be that little voice in people's heads that says, well, we do kind of have to worry about the people that elect us, probably in part because of gerrymandering and also because of the activists, the lobbyists that you mentioned. That's what this was all about, was just making the lobbyists happy, making the rabid supporters happy out there in their protests, raging against the sky, screaming at the moon. And a lot of these senators, Senator Fetterman aside, is certainly not in this group. And the other seven, it's questionable because they knew that they wouldn't pay a price. And you've had Republicans like Lindsey Graham do that, too. By the time I'm up for re-election, Lindsey Graham once said, you're going to forget all about this, whatever it was. See, I did forget. We were upset about at the moment. But Snarlin' Arlen Specter, remember, he switched to the Democrats. And what did he say? Well, I did this because this will enable me to win re-election. He's a Republican right. Elected forever, and then he switched. It's about them, and I wish more people would understand that. The people that are dependent on the government for their food and for their lodging and for their homes, I wish they would be freed from that. And I wish that more people would realize If they can give it to you, they're going to take it away from you. You're under their thumb. And I still believe that Americans, at least, have that yearning for liberty. And a lot of people in other parts of the world, but here we're built on it. And with what's happening in New York now, I'm wondering how much longer we're not going to have that conversation like the one that you had with your niece about Armistice Day and go to people and say, think about having your food taken away. Think about the movie Born Free. Go watch that, everybody. 1966. That lion is unable to fend for itself, and they think it's going to die in the wild. We don't want to be a nation of house cats with the government just taking care of us and watering us and don't go outside because it's scary. And the government shut down. I think it's good in the sense that it damaged that kind of thinking. It made people realize you shouldn't be counting on the government for your next meal.
It did not damage that kind of thinking. Dean, I disagree with you wholeheartedly. All it did is it's encouraging it. No, look, here's my take.
But if we use it, I'm saying if you use it.
Hold on a second, Dean. Hold on a second. It is encouraging that kind of thinking. You do not hear any Democrat saying, my gosh, the 42 million people that are on SNAP, number one, why did the program expand so much under Joe Biden? We know the reasons why. Number two, how can we get people off of it? Instead, the clamor is, oh my goodness, they're suffering. Let's not care about the fraud. Let's not care about the abuse. Let's not care about people, basically young adult people that could be working using food stamps as a way of life. None of those discussions are happening. It's just, let's restore the benefits. Obamacare, which is the center of all of the pain, according to the Democrats, they're not talking about how Obamacare, used by 7% of the country, has ruined the health care industry. Instead, they're saying, let's just restore these unnaturally high premiums and support for premiums and subsidies that are going to insurance companies who are making bazillions of dollars because of the way that Obamacare set it up. The Democrats are especially not interested in discussing a real fix for it. Just restore the money. Restore them sucking on the American taxpayers' teat for as long as they can. I don't hear those discussions happening. Do you really hear them?
I say it's an opportunity. I hear them happening here. I wish if I was going to presume like certain people do out there in the conservative media to tell everybody else what they should be talking about, I would be doing it. I'm saying it. I do it in my little way because you're right about defunding Obamacare. If they just mentioned that casually, yeah, Republicans should be out there saying, oh, well, Obamacare, that thing that you aced us out of, you passed on your own that we told you would cost too much. We're going to do what Abraham Lincoln said. The best way to get rid of a bad law is to make sure that it is really seriously enforced. Enforce it absolutely. We're not going to change. It's Obama's signature legislation, right, James? His landmark legislation. It was, oh, gosh, so wonderful. We wouldn't dare, Republicans should say, tamper with it in any way. And if you need us to give you the votes to save this horrible thing, we're not committing to anything. Let's start with you admitting this was designed to fail, was Obamacare, that it costs too much, just like Medicare. If you go back and look at the Medicare, I know you know this, James, the numbers of what it was promised to cost by LBJ ballooned right away. And they're out of sight now. So what I'm saying. I understand we don't have a lot of Republicans making this point, but I think that's the opportunity here is to tell people that if they can yank your chain like this and play with your lives, play with your health care because they want power, because the Arlen Specters of today think this is a great way to win at the next election, to keep myself in power, to juice you up to vote the way that they want you to vote so that they and their children's children are taken care of, going to Sidwell Friends and Yale and Harvard. And I think that's the opportunity here. Maybe I'm too positive. I've never been accused of that before. But I know what you're saying. You don't hear that. But that's what I want to hear. That's why I guess I need my own show. I shouldn't just be a guest. But that's my point, though, is it's an opportunity if we have good messaging. If you have Republicans who aren't just thinking about defending Trump and Democrats are so focused on Trump that I think it's a real opportunity for ideology to use this as what they call a teaching moment. So that's what I mean by that.
Well, I'll tell you what. Princess Diana was on with me and you know her well, Editrix of the Limbaugh Letter, of course. We worked with the wonderful, beautiful Princess Diana. And one of the things she pointed out, she went through all the things that Rush warned people about as Obamacare was coming in, including the fact that Rush said, look, just you just echoed what I had said before. Obamacare was designed to fail. Rush gave a timeline to it. Rush said, within 9, 10, 15 years, it's going to fail, and the clamoring would be there at that point for what Democrats really want, which is single-payer health care. And he expressly said, played it out how it's going to go. It is, the timeline is happening right now exactly as Rush laid out for this. Everything that was promised to the American people under Obamacare has failed. Every single promise made was a lie. And right now, the opportunity should be to make sure that that is front and center for the American people. You briefly mentioned New York. I want to play you something that Governor Hochul said. And I'd like you to just talk about for a minute. Let's talk about this Mamdani situation in New York. Cut 13, Carlos. Mamdani has promised the free stuff, more free stuff, and it's going to come at taxpayer expense, of course. Hochul was asked about that, and this is what Governor Hochul, who is now facing a challenge from Elise Stefanik, and she, believe me, is concerned about that challenge. And this is what Governor Hochul said.
We know that Mamdani does want to tax the rich more, bring it up about 2%. He can't do that on his own. You've previously said that you wouldn't be raising taxes. Have you reconsidered that stance?
No, I will say one energetic rally does not get me to change my positions, I assure you. But I do hear people's voices. I process what everybody says, but I'm also have to balance governing this state and making sure that those people who are actually the reason we have a generous, supportive budget that helps lift people up, it's their revenues that we tax. 1.5% of New Yorkers cover about a third of our budget. That's enormous. I'm concerned about out-migration of people who are the ones who are supporting our budget. I cannot make up for that with middle-class tax increases. I cannot do that to the middle class and the struggling New Yorkers. So this is the balance. I mean, this is my position.
There's some political reality in that. First of all, there's a lot to unpack with that, I think, Dean. One energetic rally is not going to change my position. Yeah, she went out, publicly bent the knee, kissed his whatever she kissed. But she's saying at the end of the day, and that the top 1.5% of taxpayers, the very people that Mondami's claiming he's going to stick it to in order to pay for his free buses, his free daycare, all these promises that he made, she's very concerned. That top 1.5% bracket of taxpayers in New York are responsible for 1/3 of New York State budget. And if they leave, it's all going to crash down. What do you think is going to happen in New York? Do you think that there's going to be a recalibration to accept reality? Or people are still going to be expecting all the freebies that were promised with Mamdani?
Well, you used the word reality there. And I think that that presupposes that there is an objective reality. And I think with a lot of people, there isn't that. I don't think that people like Mamdani, who believe what he believes, if he even believes it, I think they want to be a king. That was the headline of my New York Sun column last week, was because he quoted Eugene V. Debs, the 5-time socialist candidate for president, and they called him King Debs. And I said, boy, after that No Kings rally, kind of weird that Mamdani seems to think that he's going to be a king, that he could just manifest these things, that he can go into houses and take over the houses, that he can go into your pocket and take your money. And as for Hochul, I don't trust for a minute that that's a reality she recognizes. I would say this is the persuasion technique of
casing. You know, she's going to say the things people want to hear, like Bill Clinton in 1992. I'm going to give you a middle-class tax cut, and I swear you are going to pay less. And then what happened? He was in office for maybe, what was it, 3 weeks, 6 weeks? I've worked harder than I have on anything in my life, harder even than putting that AstroTurf in the back of my El Camino, but I just cannot give you that tax cut, I promised y'all. And that's what's going to happen here. I think they're afraid. If she's already afraid of Elise Stefanik, what happens when one of Mamdani's minions decides they're going to primary her? You don't think Chuck Schumer's afraid of AOC? They're afraid because I think that you're accurate in the sense there is a understanding of reality for a lot of these older generations of the Democratic Party where they do realize, well, we may say we're going to do a tax cut and not. Like Clinton knew that he was snowing everybody. He was fooling us and he had no intentions of cutting taxes. He wanted to spend more. But you can't say that in a campaign. I think the difference is that these people, these representatives like Hochul, like Schumer, they say, yeah, we're going to talk about soaking the rich. We're never really going to do it because those are our donors and our buddies. Look how much money Chuck Schumer took from Donald Trump back when he was just Donald Trump, right? He bashes them all now, but they all were lining up to take the gravy from the gravy train at Trump Tower. And these young communists and socialists, they believe this stuff. And the fact that they only need to look somewhere like Venezuela, look at Argentina, which 100 years ago was one of the wealthiest countries in the world, look at North Korea, where Gus Hall, who John Brennan voted for president, said that's the future, look at the Soviet Union, and you have people like George Will, who are theoretically conservative, saying, yeah, let a socialist win in New York City, because we need people to see an example. Well, is the last three bodies on top of the pile of hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dead from communism, all the suffering from Marxism and socialism, is the last three? Why? Because they're from New York? If George Will wants to ruin a city with socialism, elect a socialist in Baltimore. So, you know, this is New York
City. They already have. Everybody. They have. Their version of it. That's what the Democrat Party is. Dean, we got to... It's always a pleasure, and we got to do this more often, Dean.
I would be happy to. If the fine people in your audience want me back, it's always an honor to be on the Blowtorch, 77 WABC.
Well, this show is now syndicated, Dean. We are in many, many markets besides New York.
So, how about that? Did I insult Baltimore? Sorry, Baltimore.
Yeah, they heard you, too. So, Dean, thank you so much, man. We appreciate you.
All right. Take care.
Thank you, Dean. Dean Carianis, ladies and gentlemen, our historian, the official historian.